Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable Supreme Court of Texas is now in session pursuant to adjournment.
Thank you. Be seated. The orders of the court are on file in the clerk's office and are available for your examination. Three causes will be submitted on oral argument today. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus FDP Corporation from Harris County. Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus Eugene C. Delaney from Galveston County. And Salvador Ramos versus Frito-Lay from El Paso County. Counsel in the second and third causes are advised that you do not have to remain in the courtroom while the first cause is being submitted, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we can proceed to your cause without delay. Should an argument finish early, you may also be interested in hearing the content of some of those arguments. Counsel in all the causes are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the court. If you should desire to listen to the tape of an argument at a later date, you may make application to do so with the clerk of our court. The court will take a brief recess in between the submission of each cause, but we will finish these oral arguments before we break for lunch. In the first cause, Southwestern Bell Telephone Company versus FDP Corporation, the court has allotted 25 minutes for each side to present oral argument and 10 minutes for the petitioner to present rebuttal. We are now ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court. Your Honor, Mr. Richard P. Keaton from Houston will present argument for petitioner.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honor. This case presents squarely for Your Honor's consideration the question of whether, under the Texas law of contracts, a party will ever be able to limit the warranties that it makes in any manner in the absence of any findings of fraud, misrepresentation, unconscionability. The facts of the case are as follows. The plaintiff, FDP Corporation, entered into a contract with Southwestern Bell to place an ad in the Yellow Pages for the year 1980. Plaintiff, in that case, signed a written contract with Southwestern Bell. The facts are that plaintiff's business was in fact listed in the alphabetical listing in the Yellow Pages. Plaintiff conducted a second business at the same address, which was likewise listed and which likewise had a separate ad set out in the Yellow Pages separate from the alphabetical listing. But the ad for the hairstyling or part of the plaintiff's business, the descriptive ad that we've all seen, was in fact not printed in the Yellow Pages for 1980. So there is not an absence in this situation of a listing, but there was the omission of the ad itself. In the trial of the case, many issues were submitted. Issues on negligence were submitted, and the jury found no negligence. Issues on unconscionability were submitted, and the jury found the contract was not unconscionable. Issues under the 1746 of the DTPA, laundry list of violations were submitted, and the jury again found no violations in that instance. Issue was submitted as to whether there was an express warranty, and the jury answered yes to that question. The jury also answered yes that it was a producing cause of damages, but then on the issue of what were the actual damages, the jury answered zero. The evidence on damages, which is not a point that Your Honors granted our writ on, but which I may address depending on the time at the end, was clearly contested there was evidence, as the Court of Appeals recognizes, on which people could differ as to whether or not plaintiff suffered any damages. The evidence actually showed that the year in question the plaintiff made its highest amount of profits, that plaintiff advertised and did other promotional things in other publications and in other manners, such that a jury would be entitled to find zero damages. The evidence on whether or not the records were confused and whether or not damages were shown. But that's not the issue that we want to talk about directly today. What we have here is a situation that probably occurs often in the sales of this. Plaintiff's facts would say that at the time that the Southwestern Bell Yellow Page salesman came to the office, that the plaintiff said, "I want to be sure that the address is shown correctly." Plaintiff had moved its business during the year in question. The salesman, according to plaintiff's testimony, said, "I'll take care of that. I'll see to that." We set forth in our testimony, in our brief in this case, in the application, all the testimony relating to the so-called representations and warranties of the salesman. And they all boil down to, "Don't worry, I'll take care of it. I'll see to it." Now, the first question presented is that sufficient as a matter of law to constitute a warranty? Because all promises and all contracts are not, in fact, warranted. Our position that those words, and it is for the court to construe words such as that, we're not into a jury question, do not and did not constitute a warranty. It is a promise to do a future act. As we have seen in prior decisions by this court, notably with Sarah Grain, DTPA does not define warranty, but what we have seen running through the cases, running through the law of sales, running through the UCC is that for something to constitute a warranty, you have to have a representation of an existing fact, or a guarantee, if you will, of the performance of the good at some time. And I recognize that the cases say you don't need particular words in order to create a warranty. But certainly, every promise contained in a contract, every promise, "I will do this if you will pay me this," does not by itself create a warranty that then opens the party contracting up the liability under 1750 of the DTPA.
Counsel, since the DTPA does not define warranties, referring you to section 2.313 of the UCC, which is express warranties, can you tell the court what part of that section the plaintiff did not comply with so as to complete an express warranty?
Your Honor, if you read 2.313, as we see it, that is still referring to goods and the goods itself. And as far as we are concerned, that to state that that mere statement, "We put it in, yes, I'm going to put it in," adds nothing to the contract that was already there. It is only part of the promise and does not itself constitute an express warrant under DTPA or under the UCC, that you do not have the situation. The basis of the bargain in this situation was an act to be performed in the future. In our mind and in the law, we think that to hold that those words create a warranty is to open a Pandora's box for any contracting party.
When you say the basis of the bargain, are you referring to consideration?
I'm referring to the consideration, and you have to look at what the substance of this transaction was.
Consideration is legal consideration, which can be benefit to the promisor or detriment to the promisee.
No question about that. I don't quarrel with what Your Honor said, but what I am still saying is that we have a promise to carry out something in the future, but that rises only to a breach of contract. Breach of contract, as this court has said, does not itself constitute a violation of DTPA. Even if, however, we assume, and let's assume for the moment, and there is an amicus brief that was filed before this court by another group that argues only on this point, that those words were sufficient to create a warranty.
Before you move to that point, let me be sure I'm clear about the first one. Is it your position that that there basically is no remedy for someone who disregards a promise to do a future act in connection with a sales transaction?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. You have a remedy of breach of contract. I mean, those cases are brought all the time.
Well, my question was specifically, is there any remedy under the DDPA for someone who breaches a promise to do a future act?
If you assume no findings under one of the laundry list of DTPA, the answer would be correct. No DTPA liability under those circumstances.
And there were no Laundry Act violations found?
That is correct. They were submitted and none were found. And that's an important point, because otherwise what you will have done if you abrogate this is to open up DTPA to every garden variety breach of contract case, which we think will throw the law of this state into chaos.
Well, defining warranty in terms of whether it pertains to a future act is not very satisfactory. Doesn't a standard warranty say that the product will perform for X years, and if not, we'll replace it?
Correct, and I'm not trying, that still relates to a performance warranty of the product itself, Judge Hatch. And what I am trying to say is that itself is still a representation of performance. We're not talking, though, about an executory contract of something one party is going to do and for which one party has paid consideration.
Why isn't this a warranty of quality of service? Just like a warranty of performance is a warranty of quality of product.
I think that if you want to say that you could have a warranty of quality of service, you're going to need express, clear words that define that in terms such that a court in construing that says there's no question what the parties intended here, and the parties intended here to make a guarantee. Those words aren't said. And the situation in which someone says, I'm going to guarantee a result, or I'm going to promise this, that's a different issue, of course, than one that you may face in the next case as to what is implied in a contract and what is the standard there, tort or not.
Not very likely, but if the salesman in this case had said, I'll warrant that I'll take care of all this, would that be a warranty?
I don't think so under the facts of this case. I do not think so. Now, it's my direct answer. Let me go further in that, because that leads me into a point that we have, and that is the parole evidence point. We think that the parole evidence should, in fact, bar any addition or alteration to the written contract in this case. And we think that that parole evidence is not, in fact, something that is a rule, whether you want to call it a substantive rule or whether you want to call it a rule of evidence, that nonetheless goes to the first question of whether there is even a warranty here at all. And under the facts of this case, to admit the evidence and of the salesman in the teeth of the parole evidence rule, we think is incorrect.
But your position is still, if there had been no written contract in this case, the words of the salesman would not be actionable as a warrant.
As we see it, the answer is correct, because what you're really doing is still entering into a contract which requires one to perform, but that warranty is not the type of warranty we would submit that DTPA is talking about. You always have a circumstance in a promise that I promise to do something, that I warrant to do something. I don't see the difference in those two cases.
And so the same rule would have to apply to the aluminum siding salesman who comes to the town and says, I'll fix your roof so it won't leak.
I don't agree with that. I think that that, in that circumstance, does get to the performance of the product itself, Your Honor.
How is that different from the performance of the service involved here?
I think that you're talking about the result after the fact of the work itself. The man didn't perform. He's breached the contract. The product was put on there, and let's assume for a moment that a warranty of the type, I think it still goes to the quality of the product itself. I would.
That's what it means. I mean, unless we can get a clearer line than I understand right now, it seems like we're going to have to go to the Supreme Court of Texas every time to find out if an oral statement constitutes a warranty or a PUP or an impermissible parole comment on the terms of the contract.
I think, Your Honor, that when we deal with the word warranty, I'm going to be the first to admit that there are no bright line guidelines in either the statute or the cases themselves. Judge Spears refers to it in his opinion in Lacerra. He nonetheless talks about the present representation of fact, and he talks about the circumstance as to whether or not the breach of contract in that case itself constitutes a DTPA violation. But let me turn to, let me assume for a moment that we have a warranty here. Assume for the moment the parole evidence rule does not bar these statements. Does 1742 require that, as opposed to the limitation that is contained in the contract, that the money will be returned that you paid for the ad in the event of omission or error, does that limitation get written out because you have found a violation of an express warranty under 1750A2? The answer should be that the warranty in question, whatever it is, was a limited or conditional warranty, and therefore there is in fact no breach because the money was repaid or credited. There is no question about that. And if in making a warranty, a party cannot in fact limit what they're doing, then the freedom to contract on this kind of case in this state is severely curtailed, and we have serious repercussions in all areas of the law of contracts. Now, we would say not that there has been, in fact, no breach when you have complied with what the contract says, and that is return the money. And for 1750A2 to then say there has been an express warranty, but we're going to write out the other part of that clause, is for the DTPA are the courts in that instance to write contracts for the parties and expose them to liability that they did not contract for. Remember, now I'm not arguing here as to what would be the circumstance if a court had found that that part of the warranty was unconscionable, if we had found some of the laundry list of 1746. But we are very adamant for the proposition that the limitation under these circumstances that says this or this shows that Southwestern Bell in returning the money did not breach, and the plaintiff in this case is not entitled to proceed under 1750A2 even for the breach.
Yeah. Be sure I understand. You think that if this statement, assuming the salesman made the statement, I'll take care of it,
Correct.
If the jury had found that statement to be violative of the laundry list, then your contractual limitation would not apply.
I am assuming, for purposes of this part of the argument, Your Honor, that the first statement I made, that we have here a promise and breach of contract, not warranty, is true, is set aside. But assume that we say this is a warranty with the limitation. If the laundry list violation is found, on that instance, I think the court's going to have to face a different question. And indeed, the cases cited by plaintiff, if you will examine those carefully, what you find either is you cannot tell what this is in the lower court, what DTPA violation was found, or you actually have expressions there that the violations came under 1746, and it's on the basis of 1746 that the courts then said 1742 has no application.
What difference does it make to the applicability of the contractual limitation provision whether the jury found I'll take care of you was a breach of warranty, a violation of the laundry list, or unconscionable?
I think I can answer that two ways. One is, under the laundry list, you in effect have findings of fraud or misrepresentation, albeit statutory as such. Those kinds of exceptions have always appeared in actions on breach of contract where one is trying to avoid a portion of liability. I think that there is a difference from the standpoint of whether there is even a breach, because if it's found that these are that portion is either a misrepresentation or is unconscionable, I think then it could be written out of the contract under DTPA and recovery might be obtained. But under this situation, where all you have found is a standing alone violation of an express warranty, none of the laundry list and no finding of unconscionability, you cannot take away from the limited warranty the limiting part. Otherwise, you've taken away the warranty itself, and under that circumstance, there ought not to be any recovery at all.
Where is it in the cases that you find that distinction between the laundry list violation and not finding?
Well, let's talk one about, we have the Reinhart situation out of Judge Guittard in Dallas, where he's talking about the contractual damages, and he applied there the limitation that was contained in that in the face of the argument that it should, and there you did not have a laundry list violation. In at least one of the cases out of Houston, maybe
so
both of those out.
He applied
the limitation. But in the cases out of Houston where you find that, you see under 1746, the courts there did not apply the limitation. Now, if you want an opinion as to whether you can get a principled rule of construction here, I think if you're going to find an unconscionability as far as that limitation, I can see where the limitation's not going to apply. But to take out of the express warranty the part that also says, I'm making this warranty on this basis, that's the basis on which the warranty is being made, and not to find a violation of one of the laundry lists, we think is to rewrite the contract for the parties.
But that is a new principle that you're arguing and not one in Texas court previously.
I think you can extend Reinhart and take it and get to that position, Your Honor. But as far as I can tell from reading the cases, I see no case that directly addresses that issue. Might add, I don't see a contrary case in that sense either.
Counsel, are you familiar with the case of East River Steamship Corporation versus Transamerica? It's a 1986 United States Supreme Court, which compares whether or not you award the contract damages under the UCC or tort damages.
I am not, Your Honor, and I apologize for that.
Well, neither party's mentioned it in their brief, and I was interested in a response. It's covered in Professor Alderman's book, The Texas Deceptive Trade Practices Act, where he discusses the theory that y'all are arguing before us today.
I don't know which way he went, which way that case goes, but we'll...
The United States Supreme Court, and I was curious to hear either side address that particular case.
I confess, Your Honor, I have not read that decision.
Well, I gather we're going to hear about parts versus contracts in another call this morning. Is that an issue here?
We have a point on that because the opinion of the lower court threw in, we think, in a gratuitous way. Again, the court did not grant writ there. I don't see that really as being an issue here, Judge Doggett, because in point of fact, the situation is that they remanded on the finding of no damages for a determination as being against the great weight. I don't see that as being an issue, although it kind of varies only in, if you will, dicta of the Court of Appeals. But we don't have that directly because the jury, again, in this case, found no negligence. I mean, they did, in fact, submit the issue. But unlike the next case you're going to hear, they found a no negligence point.
Counsel, in determining between the conflict between the UCC and contract damages and the DTPA, how do we determine which type of damages? Do the damages, whether or not they're purely economic versus, let's say, personal injuries, would that be a determining factor?
No question about it. The economic loss is what you have here. And under that, we think that the rule of law that we're advocating here should apply. Yeah, I think that's correct. And I think another way of determining is to look to the substance of what are we doing, the real basis here. And what you have here is an action on a contract. This is not a sale of goods. This is not a guarantee of a performance of a machine. And therefore, the UCC, as we see it, only teaches us some of the parameters here, but it is not the governing thing for the DTPA here under the contract. But I think that absolutely the fact that this case represents only economic loss between the two parties who contract is a distinction.
Any other questions? Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The court is ready to hear argument from response.
May it please the court, Your Honor, Mr. Theodore C. Flip from Houston will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court. The representation that I will take care of seems to me to fit precisely within the definition of an express warranty as set out in 2.313. The comments go on to the code and the cases hold that there is no particular words to be used necessary, that there need not be a specific intention to make a warranty, and thirdly, that even if the representation is made after the transaction is otherwise closed, it then becomes a warranty. I don't understand the difference between the consequences of the breach of a warranty and the violation of a laundry list item. Seems to me that they're on equal parity and they should be treated equally.
I agree with that. I mean, the question is, has there been a warranty?
Okay.
Has it been breached? And if it has, is it legally cognizable?
Yes, sir.
And I assume you're going to get to all that in
the
course. Yes,
sir. Well, I hope to, Judge. The warranty that I will take care of it, I don't know how else to say except that it seems to me that it falls precisely within the definition and therefore becomes a warranty.
What isn't?
It is a warranty.
What is not under that theory? Be a warranty?
Well, if we look to the definition, was it a representation that's made by a seller to the buyer which relates to the goods, and clearly this does, and it becomes a part of the basis of the bargain, it then creates an express warranty. Now, if it fits into all three of those, anything that would become a warranty. Now, there's a lot of things that would not become a warranty under those circumstances. But clearly, when you have a contract that does not obligate the telephone company to publish the ad, as in this case, the representation by a salesman that we will see, I will take care of it, it will be there, is certainly not inconsistent with the contract terms, and it is a warranty regarding the goods.
Why isn't it inconsistent?
Pardon?
Why isn't it inconsistent? We will put it in versus we don't guarantee it.
Well, first of all, I guess we need to ask, let me start this way. The limitation that we have is not a limitation of, the limitation contained in the contract is not a limitation of warranty. A limitation of warranty would go to the existence of the warranty. The limitation contained in this contract, and they've handed it out and you have it before you, is the limitation of the damages that are recoverable as a consequence of the breach of a warranty. Now, it seems to me that there is a fundamental distinction to be made when you analyze the case along that basis, if that answers the question, Judge.
Well, I guess my question is, if this is a warranty, yes, I'll take care of you, okay, isn't any expression in the nature of a promise or covenant made during the course of any agreement or contractual negotiations or any deal whatsoever a warranty that is actionable under the DTPA?
No, sir. I don't.
Why not?
Okay. Because you could make representations even that would not fit within the definition of an express warranty within the UCC. This happens to.
Well,
there may
can
be,
you give me an example?
In a different setting or in this setting?
Any setting.
Yes, sir. If, for example, term of payment is not a warranty because it does not relate to the goods, it's not by the seller to the buyer.
Well, if the salesman said, I'll give you an extra 10 days to pay this, I know it says it's due on December the 1st, but I'll give you an extra 10 days and then he doesn't, would that be a warranty?
No, sir, I don't think it would because I don't think it goes to the goods. That may go to other contract terms that are not involved in our case right here.
May a seller who makes an express warranty under the Uniform Commercial Code limit his damages?
Yes. But he can do so only if he does it in conformity with the code provisions that say that any limitation of damages must reasonably anticipate the damages to be suffered as the consequence of the breach and must be reasonable in relation to that amount. Yes, sir. And that is not materially different whether we do it under the contract law or whether we do it under the DTPA. As long ago as 19, it's in poor form to read to the court, but as long ago as 1952, this court observed the right of competent parties to make their own bargains is not unlimited. The universal rule for measuring damages for the breach of a contract is just compensation for the loss or damage actually sustained. By the operation of that rule, a party generally should be awarded no less nor more than his actual damages. A party has no right to have a court enforce a stipulation which violates the principles underlying that rule. Now, it seems to me quite clear.
Is it a liquidated damages case?
Yeah, I think it's clearly a liquidated damages case. And that's the easiest way to analyze it, because if you do that, you remove some of the consequences of saying it is a limitation of a warranty when you recognize the true nature of what they are doing is saying, we can breach the contract, we can breach a warranty, but if we do, we don't owe you one penny of compensatory damages. All we owe you is your money back. Now, I guess you could say, well, compensatory damages would include your money back, but I mean, basically that's what it says. And in this setting, where you have somebody who is buying an advertisement for his business, that in everyone's estimation, the purpose is to generate income far in excess of the cost of it, to say that we're going to refund to you the cost is patently unrelated and without anticipation of anything regarding the damages and the consequences of breach.
Does Bell have some special duty because of their market share in this area? I mean,
Judge,
we were left out of the Brand X Yellow Pages.
We did not.
They have a better chance of limiting liability, in your opinion?
There's no question they do, in my opinion. Now, we did not formally urge that there was a disparity of bargaining power. That is one way of coming to the same result. I think maybe when we tried the case, the authority that we had no Supreme Court authority. All we had was Court of Appeal authority. It was NRE, which indicated that it was that a representation or a warranty was involved. Could not be waived. DTP damages were coverable. Measure damage the same on DTP as the contract. The answer to the question is that that would make a difference, yes. And in retrospect, we would have.
But that's not in this case.
But that's not in this case. That's correct.
Why does the parole evidence rule apply to this oral expression?
Well, it applies not for two reasons. First of all, it does not apply under the DTPA because the most recent decisions in the court that say that they're not bound by the technical rules, and most recently Alvarado, and before that Melody.
Bolton was a written statement, was it not?
It was indeed.
So, I mean, that's what pro-evidence rules about.
Maybe then, I'm thinking now of the language from the case where they say that DTPA is not a codification of the prior law, and they cite Smith v. Ball, and they say that you're not bound by the technical problems in proving a formal breach of contract or breach of warranty case.
The commentators have had a lot of trouble with Alvarado, haven't they? Trying to get you to criticize the majority of this. But they've had a hard time fitting that into the work of...
I think they have, but I'm not sure it's because of this reason. I think that it's because it involves land titles, and through the doctrine of merger, I think that it's been so accepted for so many years, without criticizing the majority of the court, that I think that it's just become ingrained in this law that the warranties, the terms of representation, whatever, in the earnest money contract are integrated into the deed, and that becomes the basis of the final bargain.
If the DTPA says if you violate a warranty, then you can get damages, and that term warranty doesn't refer back to the common law, it kind of makes it hard for us to know what it refers back to, though, doesn't it? I mean,
well,
if we're just... We have all the laundry list violations,
and
in this case and in Alvarado, you lose on those. And you have the unconscionability line, and in this case, as in Alvarado, you lose on that. And then there's a reference to warranty, and the court says that is not a common law term, but it's something we'll make up. It's very hard for us to know how to give content to it, case by case.
Well, in this instance, it is our contention that the parole evidence rule only bars inconsistent statements.
Well, surely I'll take care of it if that's the thing that's going to lead you to thousands of dollars in damages is inconsistent with an absolute limitation on liability of $2.80.
Well, it is, but then we're talking about, it's inconsistent with that, but don't we talk about the inconsistency with what the persons are obligated to do under the contract? I would hope.
But I thought you can't add a term either if it's an integrated contract. I mean, parole evidence goes more to inconsistent.
Only
it's further than inconsistent. It also...
Judge, let me respond this way, if I may. As we read the agreement, it is entitled An Application for Directory Advertising. Nowhere in the agreement is Bell obligated to publish the ad. They simply say, if we do not, we will refund your money. Now, under those circumstances, It's my opinion that it is not inconsistent to say, the salesman says, I will take care of it. It will be in the book. Now, if it's not inconsistent, and under those circumstances, I don't think we have a parole evidence problem.
So you say the application is not an integrated contract?
I agree. Yes, sir. That's what I'm saying. It's not an integrated contract. And because of that, the parole evidence rule would not bar it. Now, it would not bar it under either DTPA, and it would not bar it under traditional common law rules, because it is a limitation of damages. It is not a limitation of warranty, and it would not bar it under the UCC. Under the UCC, there is an express requirement that any limitation of damages be reasonable and be related to the amount of damage that are reasonably anticipated, can be reasonably anticipated. Under our common law, dating back as far as the case of Bassey versus, and it's cited in our brief, and Henshaw versus Kroenke, they go to great lengths. They take these liquidated damages cases and they put them square under that, and they say, this is what the test is. It is a penalty. It is unenforceable. The same as they did in this earlier case that I read from. It is a penalty and it is unenforceable in this, either a contract or under the UCC.
What was the charge for the ad in this case?
About $1,200 for 6 months. About $2,000 for 5 months. Mm-hmm. Whatever that would be carried out on an annual basis. $4,800 a year.
Why would someone sell an ad? Why would someone enter into a contract that they stood to make $2,000 if they placed the ad but lose maybe $100,000 or more if they didn't?
There is testimony in our record that reflects that the error rate of Southwestern Bell Telephone is such that for the five-state area encompassing Texas, 200 ads are omitted. 200. Now, there are other errors, and those errors are obviously less drastic. And the whole error rate together is less than 1%. Now, we're talking about many, many millions of dollars, and $800 million.
Well, if all of those 200 people lost the same amount that is claimed to have been lost in this case, that would be $20 million.
That's correct, Jared. And of that, the telephone company, Mr. Troutman, agreed that $800 million approximately is a pretty fair gross estimate. A pretty fair estimate of the gross revenues. Of that 20% profit, that's $150 million profit. I think the telephone company, as in any other business, can afford to pay its losses. I don't think it's going to break the telephone company, Judge. I don't see how it could be said they're going to break the telephone company.
Look, let me ask you a question on damages. Is it correct that there was contrary evidence on the issue of damages?
No, sir. There was no contrary evidence, Judge. Now, let me explain how that came up. We calculated our damages this way. For the years before and the years after the yellow page was omitted, my client, who is very systematic in his business, maintains 4x8 cards, or actually that's a little larger than that, and there's a sample in the evidence. And in it, when each new customer comes in, he has them check the source of their referral. We know. And the date they come in and they fill out some other personal information, we know that in 1979, some 202 people approximately, and our chart is attached to one of these briefs that we filed, is attached to the brief. It is set out where it shows 202 people come in. The year it's omitted, it immediately drops down to 77 people. It then stays flat, and when the year comes back up, the next year it goes back up to, again, approximately 200.
Well, now, you made this argument to the jury, and the jury heard that you had your best year after the ad was omitted, and they pulled you out. They didn't, zero damage.
Well, and it's our contention that that is against the great weight and preponderance of the evidence, and the Court of Appeals agreed with the judge.
Why is it not possible for the jury to infer that if you had your best year after the ad was omitted, that you suffered no damage? What is unreasonable about that?
Certainly. We don't quarrel with that. We will admit we had our best year that year. But we did it in spite of the fact that we lost, we know, an average of 125 new customers that would have come in. We're not talking about customer revenue, Judge. We're not reviewing the business records and revenues generally to arrive at our damage. We have an actual customer account, where they came from, where they did not come from, during the year that the ad was omitted, and then in following years, where they came from.
Why is this not a substitution by the Court of Appeals of their judgment versus the jury's judgment on this issue of damages in violation of Herbert, Cropper, Poole?
Because in my estimation, the fact that they had the best year ever is absolutely immaterial to the earnings that they would have received had they continued to have 200 people a year come into the shop. That is the basis of our claim. They had a good year. They had the best year. They would have had an obviously stellar year had they had the same number of customers into the shop that they had got before the ad was omitted and after the ad was omitted. Our calculations, Judge, were without reference to the general revenues of the business. We did not need that. All we needed to know was the information which we had on the cards. We knew how much the actual customer spent. We knew how often he came in. We knew what his referral rate was for other people because we have the source and we calculated that. We reduced those figures. We know what the attrition rate of new customers was. And we have all that information that we then took, compiled it, and had a CPA, who was a shop CPA, condense the information, and he projected out over a 20-year loss, over a 20-year period, about $100,000 in actual losses.
The point is the jury did not buy your argument.
Either that, Judge, or the jury bought their argument.
That's right. Contrary evidence.
No, sir, not contrary evidence. That's the disclaimer. That the disclaimer in here made my man whole. That's all I can say. I have no. There was no other evidence. There's no other evidence whatsoever in the record of any of these things that I've talked about. There's
Counselor, let me ask you, when we talk about disclaiming or modifying warranties, we're both talking about 2316 and 2317. And the code says that it's inoperative to the, in other words, a disclaimer or limitation is inoperative to the extent that such construction is unreasonable. Can you tell us why the disclaimer of the phone company is unreasonable?
Yes, because a central provision in the code is that the damages, if you limit damages, those, and they say that you can, but that limitation must be, the test is it reasonable in anticipation of the, or is it reasonable that it will accurately reflect or in some way compensate for the anticipated damages for the breach. Somebody who buys an advertisement, it's much different than me going into Foley Brothers and buying a suit of clothes. If I don't like it, I bring it back, I get back my money, I go next door and I buy another suit of clothes. Advertising is not like that. It's not buying that sort of a thing. Once you put in your application, there's a 6-month lead time. There's a tremendous amount of things that go into making it different and make it not an actionable forecast to say we're going to give you back your money. It's not at all related to that.
Well, the actual section of the code just uses the word unreasonable. There are hundreds of cases interpreted.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay. And I, while I have confessed I can't call to mind any particular case, they're in our brief and we will submit additional briefs on the point. The test is, as it is under the common law and under the cases decided by this court many, many years ago and continue to decide on liquidated damages. The test is it reasonable? Is it calculated to reasonably compensate? And it's inconceivable in an advertising situation that giving man back his money is going to do that.
This same rule, I take it, would apply to other forms of media advertising.
I think that's right, Judge. Yes, sir. It would apply to not only Yellow Pages, but I think it would apply to the salesman, the siding salesman, or whatever else. This is a general rule of contract. The Henshaw versus Conkey, for example, was one where that analysis was used, and that was had something to do with an employment contract.
Should there be a way, though, for a company that has tens, I guess, hundreds of thousands of contacts in connection with this kind of work, and which is not 100% perfect, to limit its exposure to damages in those few cases where it makes a mistake?
Only if the damages that are liquidated are reasonable with regard to the breach. Now, the DTPA has been amended this last session of the legislature to allow people to waive some provisions of it when the cost of the acquisition is over $500,000 and your lawyer signs off on the contract or agrees with you. Under those circumstances, perhaps, yes. I think GE could deal with Ford or General Electric could deal with General Motors and they would not have the problem. But we're dealing here with a consumer transaction. To me, that's different. I think it's different because of the treated differently even under the code.
Well, if they had some multiple of the ad cost four times, something like that, then might that be reasonable as a matter of law?
Well, I wouldn't think that would be reasonable. No, sir. I wouldn't think that any mechanical application of it would be reasonable.
So there can't ever really be any liquidated damages.
Well,
if they make a mistake, they buy a jury trial. Is that what you're saying?
No, sir. I'm saying that, well, can you formulate a rule that would be reasonable? I can think of none. That doesn't mean there. It's my opinion and all the limitations it implies. I don't know of any. Now, I don't think four times the cost
just made that up.
Yes, sir, I understand, but I don't think four times, I don't think 10 times. Now, maybe 100 times, I don't know, but that would have to be determined on a case-by-case basis.
You take 100 times, I guess.
Well,
your pleading was for 20 times.
Judge, at some point, perhaps, somebody can fabricate a rule that would cover it. I cannot. I don't think that it's to be mechanically implied. There is a case, the entitlement to the case is...
I mean, in the reasonable test under liquidated damages, it's what the parties could reasonably foresee at the time they entered into the contract.
Yes, sir, that is the starting
point. I mean, if you're guaranteed 100 times your return in Southwestern Bell Yellow Pages, it seems to me like every merchant would put every available dollar into it, and the pages of the book would be put
all your And I'm hard put to say that wouldn't be a good business deal, but my concern is that a good rule of law? I stumble at that.
There are some very good policy reasons for not having every misstep in human conduct go all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Well, I understand that, Judge, but there are also, you know, one way of looking at it is these people say they put accuracy rate of 99 point something or another, and it turns out that only 200 ads are totally omitted. We don't have any trouble with the truck driver who drives all the way from Florida to Maine and only misses one stop sign. We don't have any trouble with that one.
Ordinarily, when the damages are higher, folks get more careful, don't they?
I think they do, Judge, precisely. Now, I think that's precisely the point. So,
any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
A few concluding remarks. With respect, Judge Gonzalez, to your question, Alex Guevara, the lawyer that tried this case for the telephone company, argued and obviously argued persuasively to the jury and brought evidence in front of that jury that showed that the damage model that the plaintiff was arguing for was flawed. Court of Appeals recognizes there is contrary evidence, and they don't cite all the evidence. As Poole requires, we alluded to and directed the court to some of that evidence in both our application and in our motion for rehearing on our application. But the answer is very clear. Mr. Guevara's arguments and the evidence that he presented to the jury persuaded them there was no damages. To return to the focus of the case, His Honor, Judge Phillips has said, you've got three questions. Has there been a warranty? Has it been breached? And is it legally cognizable? I again assert that nothing that the plaintiff or the respondent here has said shows that anything other than a garden variety breach of contract and not a warranty. But if it is, it has not been breached is our position because the phone company returned or credited the money, which is part and parcel of that warranty.
Do you disagree that there's a reasonableness requirement that we have to apply to?
I think that that's where you're getting into the unconscionability, and that's the distinction.
No, I'm talking about under the UCC.
You're talking under the UCC. I would not argue that under the UCC, but we're talking about a sale of goods under the UCC, and I think it's a different case. If you want to look analogous to it, though, that's why I say the laundry list or the unconscionability findings may serve as a surrogate for that. But that here, you don't have that finding. Indeed and in fact, they submitted the disparity, the issue you ask about. They submitted whether there was misrepresentation and the jury found against the plaintiff on all of those issues.
So economic disparity was the jury issue.
It was submitted whether there was a disparity in value going in there. And that's under, it was a definition used under the unconscionability. And the jury, and I might add, there was a lot of evidence in the case as to alternative means of advertising, which the plaintiff, in fact, utilized in this situation. And many questions on that issue.
You're saying this was not a sale of goods, it was a sale of a service.
That's correct.
Therefore, you're not an UCC. So that would at best be analogous. And if the common law is to the contrary, we don't look to it.
Right.
And there is no concept that a limitation of liability has to be reasonable in the common law as there is that a liquidated damage.
That's correct. I mean, I think you're entitled to limit the warranty in any manner that the parties wish. And if
so
you,
somebody trades with a liquidated damage clause, they should always call it an express warranty.
Well, but the consequences of express warranty, which flow either under DTPA or even under the general law, says that they are a different creature than just breach of contract. And but even if you want to assume, which I do not think is a correct position or should be found, you in this case have no finding that would let you turn the verdict of the jury around. And I think as a matter of law, the issue ought to be found that the limitation contained in the warranty itself therefore says no breach, and that is the warranty we're talking. We're not talking breach of contract.
Forgive me for not knowing the record better than I did. But was there a claim that there's a breach of contract with this?
They did not.
That was not submitted.
That was the one they didn't submit.
No breach of contract and then consequential damages.
That's right. That's the only issue that they did not submit. And I think we know why.
They didn't sue on that, did they?
Sir?
They didn't sue on that, did they?
They did not sue on that, Your Honor. That's correct.
That's why I was noticed you.
No, but that, well,
that was my question.
I thought His Honor was really asking that question, so I couched it in submission. One point on Alvarado versus against Bolton. I don't see either the majority or the dissent in that case being contrary to the rule that I'm asking for here. The distinction that the court found itself sharply divided on, in one instance, you have an express written contract, which the court found was a warranty, followed by the deed and all of the land and property law relating to the law of merger. I realize there is talk about the parole evidence rule, both in the majority and in the dissent in that case. But I would submit to Your Honors that the parole evidence rule goes to the whole basis of what is the warranty in this case, and it is a condition, if you will, preceding or something you have to look to. You don't let those statements come in, as I see it under the law of Texas, under the parole evidence rule. I've assumed.
Do you have cases that deal expressly with an oral warranty, an oral express warranty attached to a written contract without a warranty?
I don't have
it's
such.
It's a little bit of an odd one.
It is an odd one, and I think the reason is, and indeed this gets to a point you made or someone of the honors made earlier, there wasn't a contention this was not a fully integrated contract, and all the evidence shows that it was. The plaintiff said he knew what he was signing. He knew at the time he was signing that. There's no issue as to whether this was something, so you have to look at the parole evidence rule. But it is an odd case to have, and it is exactly the reason why I think the mischief that it can create and that can creep into the law, where the salesman out there with a contract, any statement of this sort, however casual, however serious, however taken, is going to then create the warranty. If you're going to do it, you're going to have to put it in still to the context of the rest of the written contract, which contains within it the limitation that we're talking about. So I'd submit, Your Honor, that neither the majority nor the dissent in Bolton would say that the parole evidence rule should not apply here, and I do not see Bolton as being contrary in any way to the statement that we make.
If the statement had been, your business will double if you'll just buy this ad, would that statement be barred by the pro-leverage rule?
I would say it's barred by the pro-leverage rule because you're varying the terms of the contract, Your Honor. Let's assume for a minute somebody says, now you, if you have a finding of fraudulent inducement or something, you're in a different case there. But sure.
You would have confessed the DCPA laundry list.
I'm sorry, sir.
You would have confessed judgment under the laundry list in that situation?
Would I have confessed that judgment? I doubt that, Your Honor. That's not generally my character. But for purposes today, I don't think we have to reach that far. If Your Honors have no other questions, I don't think I need to keep talking. Thank you.
That concludes the arguments in the first page. The court will now take a brief recess.
The audience, please rise.